Hello there, welcome to the Tech Means Business podcast. This is Series 1, Episode 10, the best of Series 1. Now, when I was thinking about putting together this episode, I suppose I had in my mind the idea of a highlight show, some of the bon mots, or best bits, if you like, of what my guests said over the course of this series. However, having listened back to a great deal of the shows, I think there's just too much, really, to kind of cram into one episode. So, what I propose to do is just to cover off some of the big themes that are prevalent in IT and that have been emerging over the last few years. I mean, you might call them bandwagons if you like, but they've certainly been talking points, both in our industry and also, you know, out in the mainstream media too. Things like AI and big data and then more complicated, more techie stuff, really, if you like containers, and also some more political themes like the people who work in IT and the socioeconomic and demographic makeup of IT professionals. Now, back in the day, the very first podcast in Series 1 was with James Hodge of Splunk. In fact, Splunk Live was one of the last live events, I think, that I attended before the lockdown of coronavirus. So it was good to actually get to speak to James and then see him speak live as well. And I guess one of the things that really interested me about him and about his work in big data is that big data, well, we kind of think immediately, don't we? Big business and big business only. So I asked him, is the processing and the business benefits that can be gained from the processing of big data, is that just really for the enterprise players, or is it something that the smaller companies can gain from as well?
So I think as any company can benefit from looking at data and data analysis. Now with kind of SaaS software, it becomes much more accessible for people just be able to subscribe to a service and get up and running. And the key part to it is, how do I start to, you know, what do I really care about? So if we go on the large side, take someone like Airbus. So they deliver 800 aircraft a year. That's over two a day, delivering 1 million spare parts. I think we could agree that's a fairly large organization. They have some key goals, you know, minimizing the time an aircraft's not flyable, detecting, preventing warehouse issues, and then most importantly, answering customer questions as soon as possible. So that they have data in, I think it's nine warehouses, I think if I get this right, around the world. So that is a large scale problem that they have, or a business objective, to be able to make that run really smoothly. So being able to leverage the cloud and be able to get that data in as fast as possible, they can observe what's going on and jump on top of it. You think about exactly the same issue for a small company. We've got companies, one of my favorite examples was looking at elevator data. How many times does an elevator stop on each floor? This is a company that rents out their office space. So very small data. We're looking at how many times an elevator stops on each floor, and they can use that as a leading indicator to the health of each business on every floor to be able to say, do we have more or less footfall? So do we need to go and work with them on getting more office space out? And so when we think about data, what we're really thinking about is, what does it represent? It's not a log line. It's not an event. It's not a trace. It's a record of a customer interaction that took place.
Now, every industry under the sun is, of course, very fond of its own buzzwords and buzz phrases, and I guess business and technology, well, we're no exception. How about Internet of Things as a buzzword? Well, I thought I'd go straight to the horse's mouth, and I spoke to two engineers from Ubuntu about the Internet of Things, and they were talking about a containerization method that's prevalent really from the Ubuntu desktop right up into the cloud, and then also sideways, if you like, onto the edge, onto the Internet of Things, and that's the containerization method called Snaps. I asked the two engineers, Loic Minier and Galam Kayo, about all things IoT and about Ubuntu's role in that particular space.
Yes, that's right. So indeed, our Ubuntu core rendition of Ubuntu, it's based on the exact same pieces that make up like the success of Ubuntu. You know, the same kernel, same binary kernel is shipped in Ubuntu core as in Ubuntu desktop or Ubuntu server. But it is indeed made smaller and architected around Snaps. And Snaps for us are an essential delivery vehicle for this to be successful. It's really recognizing the new split of responsibilities between the operating system, the hardware support, and the application outsource. The developers of applications are being decoupled from the operating system, and we're trying to build like this common platform that can be applied to different hardware and can be combined with many different apps, depending on your specific use case, without reinventing the wheel for every single embedded design.
Now, unless you've been living under a rock for the last 10 years, you'll have probably heard of something called artificial intelligence, AI, machine learning, ML, deep learning, cognitive learning, clever machines. In fact, there isn't really a product under the sun that hasn't had that AI stamp placed upon it as some form of marketing, usually. I personally have several smart light switches in my house, which are a good sight more clever than I am. But there are some real-life uses of AI in commercially available products, one of which I chatted to about with Mariana Pereira of Darktrace. And AI is actually embedded as part of a raft of cybersecurity methods in the Antigena platform. And I spoke to her about how AI can actually work in real life.
The best thing to do with any vendor that is offering an AI technology or an AI-based technology is to test it. And that's test it in the real world and see what actions it takes and how it actually acts. And there are many different approaches to AI as well. So there are some AIs that will look for known patterns of behavior or known threats. And the idea being that if I can see it or identify it a second time, I can stop that second attack. But of course, it relies on a previous attack having succeeded so that I can then use it a second time as a marker. What Darktrace's approach has always been is to create an AI that is able to adapt and self-learn directly in the environments that it is presented with. That means that there isn't a training set of data of what good and bad look like. It simply learns normal. And with that, Antigena is then able to evolve its understanding of normal and evolve its response and take an autonomous response when confronted with something a bit different. And so these different types of machine learning and AI are very legitimate according to their different use cases. And in cybersecurity, there are many vendors out there who will have excellent products that stop known attacks from reoccurring. But the true challenge, I think, and the next challenge is going to be for businesses to stop never before seen attacks, things that we hadn't imagined or we hadn't written a rule for and we couldn't possibly anticipate.
Mariana Pereira there of Darktrace, talking all things Antigena and artificial intelligence. Now, I've spoken to a great number of really interesting people over the course of this podcast series, and I've got quite a good few lined up as well for the second series. One such person was Kirsten Wahlberg of DocuSign, who's right at the very top of her game and has had a bit of a stellar career if you check out her profile on LinkedIn or something similar, I guess. Now, personally, I've had something of an odd career. I've only actually been working in IT for 20 years or so. Before that, I trained as a professional musician, which I wasn't very good at, to be honest with you. And I also had a spell as a chef as well. I didn't actually poison anyone, but, you know, it was close a couple of times, so I thought I'd better change career. I asked Kirsten about her career at DocuSign and how she actually got into it, because she had actually done everything it is possible to do in a large enterprise without actually doing IT, and that's what she's turned to in the latter stages of her career, which I thought was a very interesting path to take. So I asked her about that.
So I think I always tell people my career path to technology was not traditional in any way, shape, or form. And exactly as you said, I dotted around. I feel as if I had a role in every single function prior to coming into technology. And what I will say is it's helped me in immeasurably. One, it's given me the lens of the customer. And so a lot of times within technology, we have internal customers and we have external customers. And so being in all the other functions, I was a customer of technology. And that lens is really important. So whenever you're trying to drive change, and a lot of times technology is a change initiative, the technology itself is the easy part. It's the changing everything around it, the processes, the people, and the culture is the hard part of it. So it gave me a tremendous empathy and understanding of what it is to be on the other side of the kinds of changes that my team implements. And that's important. So we talk about customer centricity. We talk about always, you know, putting the customer first. But until you've been that customer, you are you have sympathy, not empathy. So I have the ability to truly have that empathy. The second thing that I think it really did for me is I fundamentally understand DocuSign as a business, and every company I've been in, I really understand the company as a business. What are the problems we're trying to solve for our customers? Why do we exist? What is our value in the world? And fortunately with DocuSign, that value in the world does have a lot to do with our product, but we also do have a social mission as well. So really being able to look at the overall helps me connect and have better solutions that are more tied to the broad mission of what this company is trying to achieve and how we're trying to solve our solve problems for our customers. So I think that's been really, really helpful. And, you know, I think finally, one of the benefits of having been a customer is I have an ability to talk business with our customers. So I have the joy of spending time with DocuSign customers or prospects. And again, I know what it is. I'm deploying DocuSign at DocuSign for DocuSign. So I can have a conversation with our customers and help them see my challenges. What worked, what didn't work, what was easy, what was hard, where did I find the greatest opportunity? How would I sequence the implementations and the changes? There's so much you can do with DocuSign. How do you think about how do you do this in phases and stages? And I can have those conversations with my customers and speak their language. And really connect with the experience that they're having. And I find that a lot of times when I'm talking to DocuSign customers, we start out talking about DocuSign, but then we move to a whole bunch of other things that they're working on because I have that experience and I'm able to share a point of view.
If you've listened to more than even a couple of this first series of the Tech Means Business podcast, you'll be aware that one of my overriding passions is for free and open source software, freedom-loving software, if you like, and Linux in particular. So I was particularly drawn to Positive Internet, whose CTO, CEO, is Nick Mailer, and we were talking about how Linux really wasn't prevalent at all on the modern desktop, but he reckoned it didn't matter.
Well, what's interesting is those bunch of companies that you just described themselves are increasingly including in their offering and in their infrastructure Linux, which is fascinating. You talked about Google, of course, a completely Linux-based organization. You talked about Microsoft, who now include the Linux kernel in, I think, almost every version of Windows 10 that they distribute, as well as a full Linux distribution on top of it. Windows subsystem for Linux and so forth, and all those other host applications generally have Linux about the mix. His phone, I presume, will be if it isn't a Windows or an iPhone, will be based on Linux, which of course is what Android runs on, and so on. So the Linux kernel is everywhere and doing everything. And I think the question would have been more interesting maybe 5-10 years ago when desktop applications were still very important. Think about your average daily workload. How many very specific proprietary desktop applications do you still use? I have a text editor that I use, and I still tend to use an email client because I don't like webmail, unlike most people. Otherwise, I'm spending almost all my time in a web browser, which is peculiar to me, of course, a shell. But things like even word processors, people will usually share something in Google Docs. And if it has to be edited in Word because it has something proprietary about it, again, they use something like Office 365 to make the tweaks. So the old joke used to be, when's going to be the year of the Linux desktop? You know, because of course Linux, the distribution, doesn't usually take much market share from macOS or Windows to actually create those desktop GUIs. But that's kind of not interesting anymore. Who cares about who's drawing the window frame anymore? It's what's inside that window, which is, of course, usually some sort of web browser or a major set of components made up of web technologies like HTML5. And those are predominantly these days free and open source software based on WebKit, which, of course, let's remind us, where does Google Chrome's WebKit come from? Where does Safari's WebKit come from? And now, of course, Edge. Where does Edge's WebKit come from? Well, that started as something called KHTML, which was the basis of a web browser in a Linux desktop distribution called KDE. KDE created a web browser called Conqueror, with a K, and Conqueror's renderer was called KHTML. Apple, you know, Steve Jobs had just come back, needed a quick and nice HTML and JavaScript renderer. They found KHTML, which was released under the GPL, and Apple then rebranded it as WebKit. But of course, Apple had to continue to release versions of it, disgruntled as they were about it, because it was under the GPL. Google Chrome then also took WebKit and used it, and now Microsoft have taken WebKit and used it for Edge. So when you say, you know, it's an interesting question. Since most of our lives are now on a web browser that is based on the technology that was released on a Linux desktop, maybe Linux did take over the desktop after all.
It's great to know, isn't it, that Linux has in fact won after all. And that's a theme I'll probably be referring to many, many times in series two of the Tech Means Business podcast, where I'll be talking to, well, I've already got a couple of episodes in the can already. I'm talking to Red Hat, I'm talking to MasterCard, I'm talking to all sorts of different people. So I hope you can join me and hear me prattle on a little bit more about open source software, business, proprietary software, systems, the cloud, networks, all sorts of things, really. Anything with an electric current flowing through it that really takes my fancy. I hope you've enjoyed Series 1. I really look forward to you joining me on Series 2 when we explore some of the wild and wonderful characters that populate this particular space where tech intersects with the business world. So join me in a few weeks or so for Episode 1, Series 2 of the Tech Means Business podcast. Look forward to then. We'll be right back.